So tonight's talk is called A Guide to Getting Over Yourself. I've sort of, to be honest with you, blatantly stole that from this book I've been re reading. And a lot of what I'm going to talk about tonight is from this marvelous book called Advice Not Given by Mark Epstein, MD. Mark is a very long-time Dharma practitioner and teacher. He's also a Freudian psychotherapist. And so this book and what he has to say, it sort of blends those two things together. It's like a two flavors of thought, and he very skillfully blends them together in this the teachings he makes. And basically what he's done, and I think this is it's quite interesting, is he's taken a look at the Eightfold Path from that sort of combined point of view. And the idea behind the title of the talk, A Guide to Getting Over Yourself, is that that's what we need to do. We have to get over the idea that we're a separate self. We have to get over ourself, right? And but to get over ourself, we also have to sort of at some point get over some of our ego issues and problems that plague us and make it difficult for us to get over ourselves. And that's sort of the underlying theme of this book. Actually, I want to start by quoting, this is the quote from, he's talking about the Dalai Lama. When he speaks about meditation, he often makes a distinction between practices that quiet the mind and those that utilize the mind's intelligence for its development. Many people in both the East and West believe that shutting down the ego and the thinking mind is the ultimate purpose of meditation. I firmly believed this when I first started practicing meditation 45 odd years ago. Oh boy, I finally get to shut down my mind. The Dalai Lama rather forcefully always argues that this is a grave misunderstanding. Ego is at once our biggest obstacle and our greatest hope. We can be at its mercy, or we can learn to mold it according to certain guiding principles. Intelligence is a key ally in this shaping process, something to be harnessed in the service of one's progress. So he's saying that the idea that we sort of have to shut down the mind is never going to work for two reasons. One, it just doesn't work. Because we can never shut down the mind. It's just like that's the mind is the causes and conditions are such that stuff keeps arising there. Good luck trying to shut it down. We can slow it down, we can calm it. That's different. And there's an interesting story here in the book. I won't read the whole story, but it's about this monk who has been practicing for 4 years in a cave. And people bring him food, and he never comes out, and he's just like being really, really, really serious. And then he hears that the Dalai Lama is coming to town, essentially, and the monk shows up to get some advice from the Dalai Lama and tells the Dalai Lama what his practices are and how, he's doing this, and he's going into these marvelous states of concentration and everything. And what's the advice could the Dalai Lama give him to continue his practice? And the Dalai Lama said to him, get a life. Get a life. Like, do something in the world. Just, you can't hide away and pretend that the world isn't there. Get a life. And that's really the underlying theme about this. We sometimes, if we're not careful, we take our practice very seriously and we become very sort of grim Buddhists, like, I'm so serious all the time, and I have to meditate and don't disturb me. And that was people mowing their lawns when I'm trying to sit. How the nerve of them, that sort of thing. We can get caught in that space, and we need to understand that we live in the world. Especially we're householders. I mean, if we were monastics, it would be. But even then, this was a long-time monastic he was talking to. Get a life, and that's what he's trying to get at. But he also, so he's talking a bit further in the book here. He's talking about the fact that because he's known to be both a meditation teacher and a psychotherapist, some of his patients approach him and say, "Well, can you teach me how to meditate?" And he talks about the issues around that. And these are issues that have, though they occurred with his patients, really are things that we all have run into in our own practice or in people we know. None of these three patients felt they were doing it right. There's number one, right? One wanted to know how long to do it for, as if the length of time were the important thing. She had heard that 20 minutes twice a day was a minimum to get a good effect. She was sure she couldn't sit still for more than 5 minutes. So I told her 5 minutes was fine. And we figured out how to set the timer on her iPhone so she could not have to peek at the clock. Another person felt defeated by how tense her neck felt. She wanted the relaxation benefits right away, the stress reduction, and she was frustrated when the meditation didn't provide it. She felt the tension more acutely when meditating and became convinced she was a bad meditator. Do not think she believed me when I told her that she wasn't. The third person dropped into a peaceful and quiet state initially, and then could not reproduce it in the following sessions. She saw no value in periods that were not of the sublime character she had first tasted, and began to disparage herself. I was familiar with all these reactions, having had them myself, and worked as patiently as I could to counter my patient's newfound convictions. I wanted the meditation experience to support, not erode, their self-esteem. Turning meditation into another thing to strive for is counterproductive. Setting up too concrete a goal for oneself, even a worthwhile goal, such as to be more relaxed, less stressed, more peaceful, less attached, more happy, less reactive, is to subvert the purpose of the meditative process. This is really important. It's like we have these ideas of how this is going to be and what it's going to give me and what I, how it's going to make things better. And it just gets in the way. We turn this into yet another sort of thing to consume and another goal-oriented practice. Like I'm going to lose weight by doing, lots of aerobics or something. It's the same sort of mindset. So this section is about right view. What view do we take about the practice? And he's giving it from a very psychotherapeutic point of view, of course, of paying attention to how our mind comes up with all kinds of good reasons to meditate, or at least they seem to be good reasons to meditate. And then we turn our practice into realizing those goals, as opposed to just practicing and seeing what happens, which is what we really need to learn how to do, to not have any desires attached to our practice. So that's right view or right understanding, which is the beginning's first step of the Eightfold Path. But then we move on to right intention. Or right motivation, as it's sometimes called. I'm also using the word right because he uses that word. You could also use words like wholesome, skillful. So right has a sort of a, if there's a right, there's a wrong sort of vibe to it. And so I tend not to use that, except that's what he uses, so I follow along. Right motivation suggests that we do not have to be at the mercy of our neuroses if we do not want to be. The conscious mind, when properly oriented, can, with practice, rise above the conditioning of its subconscious influences and intentionally direct a person's activity. More often than not, as therapists know all too well, we are run by impulses we cannot see. Habitual and repetitive patterns of reactivity dominate the untrained mind. Buddhism, practical as always, takes this as a given, but says it is only a starting place. In other words, we understand that that's how our mind works. But now what do we do? And this is the right motivation or intention part, of course. We can shake free of our unconscious influences if we first admit that they are there. Ah, there's the big one, right? If we can find and identify them over and over again as they appear in our daily lives. Right motivation encourages us to come out from our hiding places, to use our powers of observation for our own good, and to be real with ourselves. It is the branch of the Eightfold Path that brings conscious intention to the forefront, and that asks us to use our intelligence to our advantage and not let our fears and habits determine the direction of our behavior. So he's talking about our habitual patterns, and also to a certain extent how we are reactive. A lot of our patterns are reactive. Like something happens that we don't like or that we do like, and we react in a very habitual way to that particular thing arising. That's what we do over and over and over again without even thinking about it. As they said, it's often unconscious almost. And this part of this, what this practice does is it sort of makes those things obvious. We can't hide from our emotional experiences. We can't deny that they exist. And we can't use meditation to avoid them, or to hope meditation will make them go away. Never works. Emotions still have a bad name in many Buddhist circles. That's another of my original experiences with Buddhist practice, where, those emotions are the problem is you have all those emotions all the time, right? Emotions still have a bad name in many Buddhist circles. When I was learning meditation, the emotions I was taught about were most often the obstacles or hindrances to meditative stability that are known to all who try to quiet their minds. These hindrances are usually listed as anger, lust, worry, doubt, and fatigue, although fatigue is given a more arcane name of sloth and torpor. Who is it that's angry? Who is it that lusts? The Buddhist teacher wants to know. Behind each of these feelings is a sense of the all-important me, a person striving to exert control at the center of mostly uncooperative universe. This way of practicing leads to a kind of paralysis, however. Rather than opening to the underlying flow of feelings that mark our connection to this world and make us human, there's only retreat and routine. In the guise of openness, emotions are shut down. Feelings are pushed away. A kind of joylessness masquerades as equanimity. This is not to suggest that it's not important to learn to detach from difficult feelings in meditation. They are not called hindrances for no reason. But the idea that they must be eradicated is dangerous. Treating emotional life as an obstacle is an obstacle in itself. It's a brilliant statement. Treating emotional life as an obstacle is an obstacle in itself. One's personal history can't be erased after all. So right intention means being willing to see all of yourself, to see all that's pleasant, all that's unpleasant, all that's neutral, all your warts, all your joyous moments. See it all and be okay with it all, and just not feel like my intention is to solve these things. We're not trying to solve anything. We're trying to be aware of them, which is a very different understanding than solving things, right? And he has a very unique view of right speech, I think. And this is the next section here. Well, right speech conventionally means abstaining from lying, gossip, vain talk, and hurtful rejoinders, all of which create turmoil in the mind. It has taken on an additional meaning for me. How we talk to ourselves is as important as how we speak to others. The way we think is as crucial as what we say out loud. Both Buddhism and psychotherapy ask us to pay careful attention to the stories we repeat under our breaths. We tend to take them for granted, but they do not always accurately reflect the truth. Right speech is traditionally presented as the first of three ethical qualities to be cultivated on the Eightfold Path. Right action and right livelihood are the subsequent two. Outer speech is emphasized because there is a choice involved in what we say and how we say it. It is rare, even when we are trying to free associate, that we can actually speak without thinking, without some kind of intentionality behind what we say. The classic approach to right speech asks us to pay attention to the space between thoughts and actions to intervene when the words we want to say have a toxic quality. It asks us to sustain from language, to abstain from language that serves no good purpose, from words that are hurtful or distracting. While the classical portrait focuses on refraining from harsh outer speech, in my view, right speech can also be applied to our inner worlds. We can catch and question our loops of thought and rein them in. How many people here have loops of thought from time to time? We can catch and question our loops of thought and rein them in, interrupting what appears to be an involuntary inner cascade. Many people are resigned to the way they speak to themselves. They do not like it, yet they accept it as a given. This is just who I am, they say when pressed. But resignation is not the form of acceptance that the Buddhism recommends. Right speech asks us to take seriously the stories we tell ourselves, but not to take them for granted. Seeing them clearly gives us back some power over them. Just because you think it, I often say to my patients, doesn't make it true. Just because you think it doesn't make it true. I can't, it's like such a wise way to think. Because how often do we sort of take our thoughts to be, well, of course, that's the truth. We get caught in that place. And just sometimes thoughts are just nonsense. Blah, 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 nonsense. And we have to be able to understand that that's also what our mind does. Sometimes it just fills our head with blah, 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 nonsense. Really, that's quite a good description, I think, of what sometimes happens. This is his summary of right speech. Right speech, in my interpretation, asks us to pay attention to how we talk to ourselves about this inevitable aspect of life, how we exaggerate its implications. So often, within the privacy of our inner worlds, we take the difficult thing and make it worse. Our own subliminal hate speech coats our experience and gives an added layer of meaning to things that are already difficult enough. Right speech says this is unnecessary. Self-criticism may still arise. Old patterns do not just disappear in an instant, but one's stance in relationship to one's inner critic can change. When one learns to observe the addictive and self-perpetuating nature of many of our thoughts, their dominance diminishes. The addictive and self-perpetuating nature of many of our thoughts. You know how we sort of that loop of thought where we go talk again, and oh yeah, and you keep telling yourself exactly the same story over and over and over again. It just flows on, and we are addicted to it, I think. Refreshed. Right speech takes the sting out of them by bringing awareness to the foreground. Refreshed by this discovery, the mind senses relief. He has a story about his mother, and his mother asked him, "I don't have to feel guilty about this?" It's a typical of this shift. Her conclusion, "I guess I could give myself a break," describes the freedom that is possible. As a therapist, I have been trained to pay careful attention to the words people use in such utterances. Phrases like my mother's "I guess" often slip in without the person being conscious of it and telegraph hesitancy or doubt. Were my mother my patient, I would push on a little. I might ask her to repeat your sentence but drop the "I guess," for example. So instead of "I guess I could give myself a break," it's just "I could give myself a break." I don't have to be so self-critical. I don't have to beat myself up all the time. I don't have to have that constant inner dialogue beating myself up over and over and over again. It's not necessary at all. It's just habit. Then we go on to right action. Here is right action classically means not acting destructively, killing, stealing, hurtful sexual activity, and intoxication to the point of heedlessness from the nucleus of the traditional ethical prohibitions. Monks take vows about these kinds of things, as these vows confer a double benefit. They protect the community by instilling a strong and shared moral code, and they protect the individual from the internal disquiet that such actions bring in their wake. Buddhism seeks mental ease. If one's actions create disease, they are obviously counterproductive. But not acting impulsively is not the same as doing nothing. This is the difference between eating compulsively and preparing a real meal. In the former, there's a blur that often leaves a feeling of disgust in its wake. Large quantities of food are ingested, but there's often little attention to its taste. In the latter, there's restraint, but no lack of activity. Right action means shopping for the proper ingredients, chopping the vegetables, making the meal, and setting the table. An enormous amount of restraint is required, even while there is much to be done. Postponing one's ego needs for immediate gratification is the core principle of this aspect of the Eightfold Path. Postponing the ego's need for immediate gratification. How often are we caught there? Something says, "Oh, I'd like something," and now we have to, we're in a frenzy of trying to satisfy that before we even know that's what we're doing. But we get caught there over and over again. And he tells this great Buddhist story. So there's two monks coming to the crossing of a river. The two men come upon a young woman who is having trouble getting to the opposite shore. One of the monks, despite his vows to never touch a woman, picks her up and deposits her on the other side of the water. As they continue on their way, the one who has kept his vows and not touched her can't stop chastising his overly benevolent friend. "How could you do that? You know touching a woman is against our vows, and you were holding her." "I put her down long ago," replies the first monk. "You are still carrying her." I've always loved this story. The monk who picked up the woman while breaking his vows did what was required in the moment. He responded sympathetically to the person in need and exhibited right action. The other monk, holier than thou, while adhering to the letter of the law, was the more attached of the two. Playing by the rules, he was looking for safety rather than paying attention to what the situation called for. His unconscious severity was structuring his response, and we can infer, masking his envy of his friend's serendipitous contact with the stranded woman. Even after his friend had put her down, the second monk was still obsessing over her. While endeavoring to be a good Buddhist, he was inadvertently revealing just how difficult it was for him to let go. Buddhist tales make this point over and over again. Our lives are made dull by our efforts to over-control things. The joy of creative expression arises out of surprise. If we live our lives like the overly severe monk, thinking only about the rules, we walk through life with blinders on. If we can be open, like the first monk, we find that life's unpredictability is full of interesting and invigorating challenges. These challenges engage us in unexpected and unanticipated ways and allow for freedom of unscripted responsiveness. Right action is more than just reaction. It springs from an attunement to the moment that confines of convention obscure. I love this definition of right action because it sort of, it makes us be mindful all the time. You know, it's like we come across a situation and we go, well, yeah, I should do that. It makes sense to do that. Now, even though, you know, conventionally it would be a no-no or, you know, against the rules, it seems like the right thing to do. And of course we have to watch because that would, we also get caught in fooling ourselves all the time, thinking, well, we'll be okay this time. So there's a matter of, this is like acting virtuously is a practice, and it requires us being mindful and paying attention to what's happening in the moment, like right, what's happening right now, and then reacting appropriately. Move on to right livelihood. And right livelihood is the third of the ethical trilogy that began with right speech and right action. Classically, it means avoiding some of the worst qualities human beings are capable of, those involving deceit or exploitation. Examples from the Buddhist time included trading in weapons, buying and selling human beings, killing animals, selling drugs or other intoxicants, and manufacturing or distributing poisons. As these ancient examples suggest, things have not changed very much. People still make great fortunes in the very industries the Buddha warned against, although there are a few modern variations, like the trade in subprime mortgages he could never have envisioned. Right livelihood, from its inception, has asked people to consider the ethics of how they make their money. As with right action, the original idea was to protect the Buddhist community from its own most corrupting impulses with an explicitly stated set of moral principles. As satisfying as it might be to make money at other people's expense, the Buddha was sensitive to the covert cost to the mind. By introducing a clear set of moral precepts into the Eightfold Path, he was safeguarding his community from within and from without. In encouraged reflection of one's vocation, right livelihood brings up a number of provocative questions. I've had to deal with this a couple of times. What place does work have in my life? What is driving me? Do I have ethical qualms about my job? Does my livelihood define me? Is my salary the most accurate reflection of my worth? The Buddha said that most people are motivated by what they call the eight worldly concerns, gain and loss, pleasure and pain, praise and blame, and fame and disgrace are the ones he specified. He was careful not to judge people for these preoccupations, although he cautioned that they all come and go. Despite their relative impermanence, many of them are referred to with the utmost respect in the Buddhist ancient discourses. At one point, the Buddha remarks that there are four kinds of happiness a householder should seek: ownership, wealth, debtlessness, and blamelessness. So it's okay, we're householders, it's okay to have things and use things to act in the world as an intelligent citizen. It's when we want more than what we can hand, and we don't lead a virtuous life, when we don't share what we have, that's when the problems arise. He goes on. Right, well, Ivyat asks us to pay attention to the eight worldly concerns and try to find a place of balance within them. Do we chase praise, profit, pleasure, and fame as if they were the most important things in the world, as if once we corral them, they will last forever? Do we make our failures the linchpin of how our low self-esteem? Do we judge ourselves on whether we can avoid pain and loss? If we allow our identities to rest only on such things, we are destined for disappointment. There's always someone wealthier, more famous, more recognized, or more accomplished than we are. Always someone more like, with more likes on social media. The effort to maintain our status, wealth, youth, position, beauty, recognition, or prestige can be an endless source of consternation. And the self-criticism that surfaces under the spell of inevitable loss, pain, blame, and disgrace can be devilish for a lifetime. And what he's driving at here is right livelihood has a lot to do with, does my livelihood help me further my practice, or does it get in the way of my practice? That might be a good way to express it. Is what I do to have the income I need to live a life in the world, does it get in the way? Does it slow me down? Does it stop me from practicing? Does it fill my mind with concerns, distress sometimes? And I'll give you a little personal example of this. In one phase of my earlier life, I was a dweeb, a computer guy. This is back in the 60s, 70s, early 80s. Was quite good at it, to be honest with you. And at one point, I got this really interesting job. I was working for a company that built automated mapping systems. And this is way before, things like MapQuest and all these things. This was like mapping, literally drawing maps on paper. And I was on this project to help the government of Australia build this. We were going to build a system for them that they could use to map their coastline, because Australia is, this gigantic island. It has had thousands of miles of coastline that were just not mapped or mapped very poorly. But they had all this interesting data that they collected and were continuing to collect, and we were going to automate that whole process. Very fascinating work from a technical point of view. I spent 6 or 7 months building this system, and then I went off to Australia to deliver it. And interestingly enough, I went where I was delivering it to was the Australian Navy, which made me pause and think a little bit, but it had been really interesting. And so then as I was there doing this 2-week delivery process, I asked one of the Navy guys. I said, "Well, why is the Navy the one who's, isn't this like the Department of the Interior or somebody who should be paying attention to the coastline?" He said, "Oh, no." He said, "The Navy really is concerned about this because if we don't know where our coastline is and where the deep bays are, we don't know how to find the Russian submarines that are hiding in our waters all the time." And it was like, boom, like the light came on in my mind. It's like, oh my God. I'm basically working in this really interesting project that was really exciting and interesting to further not very pleasant work that was planned by these people to use the system. And when I was finished, I went home, and 6 weeks later, I had a new job. I just left the job completely. Couldn't do that sort of stuff anymore. But it was like, I was just so blissfully unaware until I paused to think, oh, wait, What are the ethical implications of what I'm doing? As opposed to, isn't this a cool, interesting, exciting thing to do? It's so easy to get caught in those sort of places. And we have to sort of be aware that that's we have those tendencies, anyhow. So that's right, left, life. Then we go into right effort. And right effort, he has some interesting things to say again, of course. And once again, he starts with using a classic story from the Buddhist time. An energetic disciple named Sona came to the Buddha for help and advice. Meditation was frustrating him. Anybody ever been there being frustrated by your practice? Despite exerting himself to an extreme, Sona was unable to find the freedom that the Buddha extolled. Sona was a musician by training, a lute player, and the Buddha used this fact to give him some specific instruction. "Tell me, Sona," said the Buddha, "in earlier days were you not skilled in playing string music on a lute?" "Yes, Lord." "And tell me, Sona, when the strings on your lute were too taut, was your lute tuneful and easily playable?" "Certainly not, O Lord." "But when, Sona, the strings on your lute were too loose, was your lute tuneful and easily playable?" "Certainly not, O Lord." "But when, Sona, the strings on your lute were neither too tight nor too loose, but adjusted to an even pitch, did your lute then have a wonderful sound and was easily playable?" "Certainly, O Lord." "Similarly, Sona, if energy is applied too strongly, it will lead to restlessness, and if energy is too lax, it will lead to lassitude. Therefore, Sona, keep your energy in balance, the spiritual faculties, and in this way, focus your attention." The Buddha has given a lesson in meditation to the former musician, helping him relax his effort so that he could find ease in his practice. He was showing Sona that attention was his instrument now, that it was could be tuned just as his lute had been, and that it was possible and desirable to keep it adjusted to an even pitch. As a musician, Sona was aware that his tuning was not a one-time thing. An instrument requires care. Keeping it in tune is an ongoing process that requires a steady deployment of energy to keep it right. Sona was encouraged by the Buddha's advice. He did not have to be at the mercy of his ambition. Not at the mercy of your ambition. Sometimes when we get caught in efforting, over-efforting, it's like it's because we want something. We have this ambition, like I'm gonna be the best meditator, or I'm gonna reach that experience, just like I read in that book or whatever. We get caught in that place of wanting so strongly that it gets that wanting in and of itself gets in the way of the practice. This is not always as easy as it sounds. Till one becomes familiar with one's instrument, it's impossible to settle into a good rhythm with it. Musicians are not the only ones to appreciate this. Athletes who have experienced being in the zone have an intuitive understanding of it as well. When they lock into their game, there's a sense of effort proceeding effortlessly. While they cannot make this effortlessness happen magically, some players develop a sense of how they tend to get in their own way. This awareness allows them to consciously adjust themselves. This is so true of meditation. And what we have to learn is that we can learn through paying attention to what's arising as we apply effort, whether we're too tight or too loose. It's like the experience of the practice changes quite dramatically sometimes when we're too tight or too loose from that sort of medium ground that we're always hoping to find. Then there's one other thing here that he says. My favorite part of the Buddha's discussion with the lute player is his recollection of the wonderful sound the instrument had been when it was in tune. The Buddha was referencing the joyful aspect of things that come out of right effort, something Sona might have forgotten in his overly ambitious pursuit of liberation. The Buddha obviously wanted Sona to take pleasure in what the proper deployment of his intention could bring. This is so important that we remember this and we keep going back to this, like, oh, we're supposed to enjoy our practice. What a radical idea, huh? That we're supposed to enjoy our practice. But if we're not enjoying our practice, and I'm not saying that sometimes it's not going to be difficult and horrible, because it is. But we can even enjoy that, because sometimes in the midst of the difficult and horribleness, we have an insight into something and we go, oh, and there's that joy of insight arises. We can never forget this. It's the effort has to, the practice has to have this aspect of joyfulness coming with the practice, embedded in what's happening, in a sense. Then he says one other thing in this section right after that I've never encountered in any other place. I just found it really interesting. Right effort is not only helpful in the psychotherapy office. It is relevant in any situation in which strong emotions or habits threaten to carry people away. It takes a different kind of effort to go to an AA meeting or call one sponsor than it does to take a drink, for example. It takes a different energy to restrain oneself from saying something nasty than it does to not lose one's temper. And it takes a more concerted strength to remain quiet around one whose adolescent child, quite around one's adolescent child, than it does to give repeated advice when it is clearly not welcome. Right effort suggests that it is possible and often desirable to gain control over one's ego impulses. The precondition for this is the ability we all have, often underutilized, to observe our own minds and learn to restrain ourselves. Sometimes restraint is extremely skillful, and it takes a lot of effort. It's much easier to just sort of blab and blurt and fall into those habitual patterns than it does to sort of, oh, this is one of those times that I should just sit back quietly, maybe with a wise smile on my face, but just not get gripped into yet another iteration of that same old stuff. Just restrain myself, hold myself back from my habitual patterns of reaction. Then we get to the last two steps here, and this is right mindfulness. Mindfulness is the aspect of the Eightfold Path that has received most attention in the West. It is the distinctive attentional strategy of Buddhism that has found acceptance in a variety of fields, ranging from business to basketball to psychotherapy. Rather than restricting one's attention one pointedly to a single object of awareness, as in most other forms of meditation, mindfulness encourages a dispassionate knowing of thoughts, feelings, memories, emotions, and physical sensations as they come and go in the mind and body. The general idea is that it is possible to empower the observing self so that one does not have to be swayed by habits and impulses or taken over by one's inner critic. We don't have to be reactive. One learns to dwell in an enlivened awareness rather than being hijacked, sidetracked, or seduced by the usual array of thoughts and feelings. What is not usually emphasized in the excitement over mindfulness in the West is that, from a Buddhist perspective, mindfulness is an introductory technique. It's an entry-level practice whose purpose is to open doors to insight. Contrary to many people's preconceptions, being mindful is not the be-all and end-all of meditation. The Buddha, in his famous parable, compared it to a raft made of grass, sticks, and leaves that helps someone cross a great water. What should be done with the raft once you have gotten across? He asked rhetorically. Should you carry it with you for the rest of your life, or put it down by the side of the riverbank? In making this comparison, he is trying to stop people from becoming overly attached to his method. While his warning was powerful, it has not prevented many over the years from fetishizing their technique. The trick of right mindfulness is not to turn it into another method of self-improvement. So easy to end up there. Oh, I'm going to meditate because it's going to make me a better person. That was never the intent of the Buddhist teachings. It's just, you have to keep remembering that the practice is just skillful means, that eventually the actual energy, the mental formation of mindfulness will arise, which will allow us to gain insight into things. The whole practice, this, you know, paying attention to your breath and all those things we do, and, you know, noting things, and all this is just treating causes and conditions such that the actual mental formation of mindfulness can arise, which is just like anything else. It can arise, it can be there for a while, and then it'll be gone. And the method is a way of creating the space for that to happen, so that then we can start seeing more clearly. And we forget this. We forget this. If you look, here's one place that this becomes really obvious, this was the Buddha's intention, is when you, if you look at something called the Seven Factors of Awakening, which is one of the principal teachers of the Buddha. And this is sort of a progressive description of the places the mind goes to, the mental formations that arise over time that take you deeper and deeper into the practice. The first of these is mindfulness. It's essential. Mindfulness is essential for everything else to happen. But it's just the beginning. From mindfulness, the first factor of awakening that leads to the other six. So it's like, we can't think, oh no, all I have to do is be mindful and everything will be okay. Mindfulness leads us to further understanding of things. He goes on here. He's talking about how Tibetan physicians treat patients, which is interesting, but I'm not going to read that whole section. The wisdom of the Tibetan physicians is important to keep in mind as mindfulness takes root in the West. Much of our culture is built on striving, and many people have trouble leaving this mindful mindset behind. The very word mindfulness tends to encourage this overly aggressive approach. It can be sound admonishing at times, carrying with it the injunction, be mindful. There's a ring of the Protestant ethic to it. This is not accidental. First used in an English translation of the Buddhist text in 1881, at the height of the British colonization of South Asia, the term mindfulness came into general acceptance in the Western world thereafter. So this was a Victorian gentleman translator. So that Victorian stern energy is there. But the term is a Western invention. The original word in the language of the Buddha's time was sati. Sati means remembering. Right mindfulness, or right sati, means remembering to keep an eye on oneself. It's the opposite of forgetting or absent-mindedness, the kind of forgetting that happens all the time when one is lost in thought. The distinctive quality of mindfulness is that it remembers. Once established in the mind, it remembers itself. A clear description of what is meant by sati might be presence of mind. I like both these. I really like the term remember as a translation of sati. Because when you think about, there you are practicing, right? And we're using the technique and we're following along. And then something catches our attention and the mind wanders off into some story or some blah, blah, blah. Something happens. And then at some point in that process, we remember, oh, I'm sitting. I'm doing my practice. But it's that remembering that brings us back to the practice. All we're trying to do is to keep remembering what's happening and what we're doing. We're trying to remember that we're being doing what we can to create the causes and conditions such that mindfulness will arise in the first place. We just need to remember, both in that in the moment to moment thing, but also it's like, you know, if you have a daily practice, you know, sometimes I get up in the morning and I'm already distracted when I get up, and I have to remember, oh, wait, this is while I practice. And then I'll go practice. Or I'll remember, you know, I need to go on a longer retreat. I'm trying to go and do something of greater length. Because I can remember what it feels like to have done that. So remember it and comes on more and more frequently is as a way to think about it. I also like the term presence of mind. Like having presence of mind means we're engaged with the mind, but it's not running the show. We're aware of what's arising at the level of mind and not letting it be in control. And not that we can control what's arising, but what we're learning to do is not be reactive to what's arising. That's the key to the practice, is to learn to not be reactive to what's arising, all that nonsense that keeps arising. Because otherwise, one thing will just lead to another. And, you know, I'm sure you've all experienced this. You'll be sitting, and then it's like, oh, and you look at, oh my God, 10 minutes just went by. Where was I for those 10 minutes? Who knows? You were probably in five different chains of thought by that point. One thing led to another, led to another, led to another. Because we weren't remembering. All that was happening is we weren't remembering anymore. Which leads me to the last of these things in the Eightfold Path, the concentration. And I actually want to read something from Joseph Goldstein here. This is from his book, Mindfulness. He's talking about concentration. It's interesting to note that in the Abhidhamma, Abhidhamma is a commentary on the teachings written around 2,000 years ago that is frequently quoted in this tradition. It is interesting to note that the Abhidhamma, one pointed, this is a common factor, which means that it arises, at least to some degree, in every moment of consciousness. If there were no concentration or one-pointedness at all, we would never be able to connect with an object. But even though some degree of one-pointedness is always present in order for us to know anything, this factor of mind is often weak and unstable. The Buddha described this familiar condition in one verse of the Dhammapada, saying, "The mind, hard to control, flighty, alighting where it wishes, one does well to tame. The well-trained mind brings happiness." It's like training a bird. Most of us can probably relate to the flighty mind, alighting where it will. How often do we get caught up in trains of associated thought before we even realize that we're thinking? But it's important to remember that the mind can be trained, and the factor of concentration can be strengthened with skillful practice. The Pali word for meditation is bhavana, and it literally means causing to be developed. Just as our bodies get stronger through physical training, concentration gets stronger through mental development. So this concentration, in some sense, I think it sort of comes to some people more easily than others. But I think a lot of it just has to do with practice. It's like everything else. You want to learn how to play the piano, you practice, and then you start to be able to be playing, chopsticks. Now you're playing Brahms or something, right? Why should practice be any different? We practice and we develop our ability to concentrate over time. But we have to remember that concentration isn't the end of the process. This is something that we often fall into as well. I was going to read from the sutta, but I'm running out of time. There's this whole section where the Buddha is describing his early life after he ran away before he was enlightened. And he went to these two different great teachers of the time who taught certain concentration practices. That was their thing. And he very quickly grasped them, and then he could go into these deep states of concentration where basically the hindrances are gone. I mean, you're just in this calm, peaceful, pure state. But in both cases, he then realized, yeah, but then I come out of concentration, here I am living in the world again, having to, make sure I have clean clothes and get a meal. And all that calm, still space is gone. Concentration isn't the answer. It's part of the answer, along with mindfulness and effort. And we balance those three together and somehow find a road to moves towards enlightenment, at least. One last bit here. Of course, I couldn't do a Dharma talk without a bit of poetry. This is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. And it describes pretty well, I think, what Mark has been talking about the whole time and what I've been nattering about for the last almost an hour now. It's called The Fruits of Practice. Despite fervent pleas for ease and safety, there are many days when reality does not quite line up with what I'd choose. Breakdown, letting go, surrendering even the illusion of control, breathing into the unknown. Sometimes that is what life holds. Practice hasn't brought an end to pain. I still increase my suffering like a fish caught on the line. My struggles only draw the hook in deeper. But being in reality is its own reward. It's the perfect paradox. The courage to stand and breathe when everything in me wants to flee is as great a gift as the freedom to seek retreat. No, practice hasn't brought an end to pain, but has honed my willingness to experience the moment and sometimes see perfection unfolding in ways I wasn't big enough to plan, let alone predict. Practice isn't about achieving a goal. It's not a means to pole vault over suffering. Practice is my way of looking life in the face and saying yes to all its disparate gifts. Practice keeps me awake when I would sleep and reminds me it's the journey unfolding in this very moment. It's the journey that reveals the truth and not the destination. That sums up Mark's whole book in one beautiful poem, I think. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.